So again, tonight's topic, we'll be looking at wildland fire behavior. My personal experience of all the times I've had close calls of being killed in the line of duty, it's this environment by far that's been the most risky. This is the Oakland, this picture here at the opening picture is Oakland Hills fire. I was there, Mount Vision fire, Malibu fires, and so forth. So I've seen quite a bit of wildland fire behavior and seen people get hurt and get killed. In 2003, I lost a good friend of mine on the Cedar fire near San Diego. So,
how do most firefighters die?
Usually how they die?
Do they get crushed typically?
Typically they get overrun. They typically get overrun by the fire. Is a lot of the firefighter deaths. And another thing too is trees falling on them and stuff like that. That's one time I heard the crackling of the tree when I was younger, and I can hear. I hear a crack behind me, and I looked behind, and I jumped out of the way, and got out of the way, and it caught the back of my leg. If I were staying right where I was, that tree would have just squished me like an acne blemish. I would have been dead. So there's a lot of things that can happen to you on the wild, on the fire ground.
That, or if you get burned over, it's burning slow, then you just get cooked like a potato inside there.
Yes, that is true. But usually those work pretty good. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at factors impacting wildland fire behavior. Fire triangle, which we've been forward with this class, we're highly advanced by understanding the fire tetrahedron. So in the wildland arena, the fire triangle is used because you're dealing with being fed by atmospheric oxygen and the fuels that are burning or normal class A char-forming fuels. The heat, we'll look at the modes of heat transfer, and the two big ones are convection and radiation. We'll look at the environmental elements such as weather, the four factors of fuel and fire spread, and of course wind effects. Wind is the biggest player in wildland fire behavior, bar none. So we'll talk about the three weather factors in wildland fire behavior. We'll talk about slope, four factors of topography, and what are some of the basic danger signs. So what's the danger signs of a box canyon as opposed to a ridge or, you know, a slope. So we'll take a look at the topographical features and what the associative hazards are with them. And then this is from before. So your question will be, again, 10 questions and then two short answer ones. So the fire triangle, the modes of heat transfer, radiation, conduction, convection, environmental elements. So what do you think some of the environmental elements of fire behavior we'd have to take a look at?
Wind.
Wind is the big one.
Humidity.
And temperature, right? Depending on the time of day. Because usually when the temperature's low, that the humidity usually recovers. So, you know, you can get dew and all that. And the four factors of fuel that affect the start of and spread of a fire, and the three factors of weather that affect fuel moisture. So we'll talk about those in more detail. The role of winds in fire behavior, how slope will affect the spread of fire, the four factors of topography that impact wildland fire behavior, describe the danger signs and potential dangers that can develop in a box canyon and steep, narrow canyons. Because in our area, we have a lot of these. And you see some people, you know, you drive and people will build their houses basically on the muzzle. They might as well build it at the muzzle end of a cannon barrel. You know, they build their houses in that, or they build them on these steep, narrow canyon slopes.
They're right at the top of a ridge.
Yeah. So, yeah, the worst possible spot you can be. Oh, but the view is beautiful. So again, the fire triangle, oxygen being fed by atmospheric air. Wildland fires are generally just totally fed by atmospheric oxygen. That's why they get that's why wildland fires are such a big deal, is because they don't get starved of oxygen. Very rarely do they get starved of oxygen, because they're being fed by the Earth's atmosphere. And then the fuel types generally are very porous, meaning that grasses, you know, needles, all these things add up to where the fire gets going, and then all of a sudden it can just it will expend its energy so quickly. A lot of firefighters have been hurt and killed by grass about this tall. And we'll look at some video clips of wildland fire progression and so forth. So again, the thing that's unique about wildland fuels is moisture, fuel moisture. Like in a typical structure fire environment, it's usually pretty dry. So fire gets going and it can take off. But in order for wildland fire, the fuel moistures have to be at certain parameters for it to work, for it to even take off. And if it is there, the heat, if there has a lot of moisture, you have to drive that moisture out before you can get ignition. So again, go ahead and just take a seat. We just basically got started. So radiation is a big deal. And I've known throughout the semester thus far, I've talked quite a bit about how radiation impacts. I've seen radiant heat, you know, 2D9, those are blade widths, or over a 4-lane highway. I've seen the radiation hit the other side and ignite it. And then if that doesn't do it, then the convection's throwing firebrands to the other side, and then you get what we call area ignition. And area ignition is a wildland's version of flashover. It's you get all these firebrands or radiant flux, it's hitting the other side, and then all of a sudden the whole area erupts in flame. Convection, okay? Convection, what that does is the flames can be laying down, and it can, so especially on a slope, it can run up that slope and preheat the fuels ahead of it. So again, so the steeper the slope, the greater chance of that preheating of the fuels downline from that. And that's why these fires, once they get going, I haven't met anybody that can outrun one yet. Usually you die trying. And then again, convection is a subset of conduction, because the heat transfers through a fluid medium, in this case being the air. So conduction doesn't play a big role in wildland fire behavior. Why do you think that might be the case? Why do you think conduction is not a big deal in wildland fuel? No, it's what's the nature of the fuel?
Metal.
Wildland fuels are metal?
Not metal.
Not metal. Okay. All right. I just heard metal. Well, unless you get one of the old time metal Christmas trees. But I remember friends of mine, growing up Jewish and stuff, but visited friends, and then they had these big aluminum Christmas trees in their houses, in the 60s. Those are classic. And the big old disco ball color light shining on it and changing the colors. But so wood is a very good insulator. So wildland fuels are very good insulators. But what it does do is, since it doesn't conduct very well, the fire can incubate. So like when lightning strikes hit, they can smolder for hours or days before they break out into a fire. So they're real good about retaining heat and smoldering and smoldering and smoldering away and smoldering away for days and hours and days, and then all of a sudden they can pop up. So the environmental elements are probably the most difficult to predict, and weather being the big culprit. Weather can change on a dime. I've been witness to this, where we're getting a ring around the fire, and then all of a sudden the humidity just plummets, and then the wind directions change, and all of a sudden you see all these brands and all these little spot fires going, and the whole area just erupts. So changing winds, dropping humidities, temperature increases, all these things conspire against you. And they can change at a moment's notice. So temperature. So like anything else, like we've talked about before, we need to have the higher the temperature the fuel is, the closer you're that point of reaching the ignition temperature of it. And especially if wildland fuels have a relatively high temperature from, you know, being in the direct sun, that means the moisture's more than likely been driven off. And usually it's about 10 degrees Celsius, 50 degrees Fahrenheit between the fuels in the shade and the fuels in the sun. But usually the fuels in the shade are going to have a much higher moisture content. So if you look at a mountain, right, you go on the west side, southwest side, what is it, grass and some brush. But then you go on the northeast slope and you got heavy trees and you can have moss hanging down from the oak trees on the back side, because it doesn't get nearly the sun that the southwest exposure gets. So depending on where the fire starts can play a pivotal role on how quickly it's going to spread. So again, between about 10 degrees Celsius is the difference between fuel in the sun and fuel in the shade. So wind, by far, of all the environmental issues, has the biggest role to play in wildland fire behavior. Santa Ana winds, or Föhn winds, which come from a German term meaning winds that come from the Alps, and they're wind events that last days, not mere hours. So like sometimes what we'll do is we'll have the winds in our area during the summer blow out, you know, blow come from the east, blow to the west through midday and part of the afternoon, and then usually in the later afternoon, and then all of a sudden the wind will switch and go blow from the west, blowing to the east. But when we have our version of the Santa Ana winds, or our version of the Föhn winds, or what we call the north winds, meaning that they're blowing out from coming from the northeast, and they blow for a day or more, usually several days. So like when we get those days where we have the high fire danger, or red flag days, those usually occur because these particular winds, which we're going to be talking more about, are extremely dry, and I'll relate some humidity tests that I had done during certain fire campaigns that I've been on. So again, wind will drive these things. One case in point, just a real quick one. In Mill Valley, 1993, it was a typical September day in Mill Valley, sometimes where, you know, it's fog and the eucalyptus trees are dripping water because, you know, the fog, the coastal influence and all that. Well, these people were open space, they were welding some gate on one of the fire roads, Gesundheit, and a spark hit, landed in the brush. The fire took off. Gray Slick from Jefferson Starship, if anybody knows who that is. Fire ripped through, hit her house, destroyed her house. We barely stopped it. We could have lost that whole neighborhood in Mill Valley. But, you know, and that was the weather was crappy that day. So, but if it has a wind behind it, it can, even under foggy conditions of wildland fire, it could take off. So again, that's just a point of showing you how big of an impact the winds have on these environments. So let's take a look at what does wind do for wildland fire behavior. It increases the supply of oxygen, influencing the direction of fire spread, drying of the fuels. So we, you know, usually we have 1 hour fuel, 2 hour, 3 hour, 4 hour, 5 hour, 10 hour, 100, 1,000 hour fuels. And what they mean by that number is, so let's say a 1 hour fuel, which is typically usually a 5.5 millimeters or a quarter of an inch or smaller in diameter. Meaning that, let's say that if that fuel moisture was 50%, And if we had it exposed to an environment below 50% impacting it, then it will lose that moisture within in that hour. So, but winds can take a 1 hour fuel and dry them out in as little as 10 minutes. If you have a good dry wind blowing on it, it will dry those fuels like that. So those are things we really, really have to be wary of. So the ratio of the amount of moisture in the air. Go ahead.
What would you do if there's a fire tornado?
Huh?
What would you do if there's a fire tornado?
It's kind of like Sharknado. You know, they did have a Sharknado where they had one where it turned it, there was a fire one. But no, what you do is you take a look at what direction that firewall is moving. Generally, what they do is the firewalls form on usually the boundary of the fire line, so the flame front is coming across, and you're getting the warm and cold air colliding. They'll make these whirls, and these whirls will cross your line. But what you do is you just see what. If it's moving this way, you just move perpendicular to that, and then you're out of harm's way. But
none of those in California.
No, the firewalls have happened. I've seen them where they've come. Where they get up a good head of steam going. Especially what they can happen is in some of the heavier fuels. Matter of fact, we're going to take a look at some firewalls on the line and some guys filming it and some of the big issues that they present, because man, they I've seen them where they just come across and they just, you know, you cut your hand line and everything is good, and the thing just goes right across it and it starts the fire on the other side. But at least there are no sharks. Sharknado 4, saw that the other day. That was classic. Yeah, that's the yeah. They made a fourth one. Yes.
Favorite part.
I like the part where they. Where they get the, where a guy gets like fire extinguishers and throws them into the tornado and then shoots them and they explode, and then that stops the tornado. And I go, wow. I go, I guess I all my experience in learning meteorology and pressure boundaries and what it takes
sharks
to.
Sharks can aim at people half a mile away. And just take them out.
Yeah, and then of course the sharks come out.
Do they have like water in the tornado?
Yeah, it's like a water tornado and sharks just attacking.
They attacking people with pinpoint accuracy. So when we get into a low humidity environment, the moisture starts getting wicked away from the fuels. And again, wildland fuels are, we need to drive out that moisture again. You know, if anybody who's used burnt firewood or everything, you know, you keep tabs, and if you're from, you know, 7 to about 15%, the wood is good to burn. It'll burn clean and hot, and no creosote buildup and that. Well, as that moisture drops, and again, the light flashy fuels are going to be the first ones to lose their moisture, and they're the ones that are going to ignite the easiest and burn the most rapidly. So that fuel moisture is just basically telling you the percentage of moisture in the fuel by weight. So like green fuels, they call green fuels 100% fuel moisture because, you know, they're all, you know, wet because they're growing and they're, you know, totally saturated. And then as the percentages drop, then the combustibility of that fuel becomes higher and higher. So precipitation, again, this is a weather phenomenon, basically rain. It could be rain, and rain can be snow, it could be hail, it could be drizzle.
Sleet.
And those are the things that are going to have the major impact on. And the thing, people think that, okay, if you get a thunder shower that drops a 3/4 of an inch to an inch in an hour, and then you get another rain front that maybe will drop the same amount in, let's say, 12 hours, just light drizzle all the way. The one that's light drizzle over a longer period of time is going to have the biggest impact on fuel moisture, because the humidity, the atmospheric humidity, is going to be at 100%, and then that water is just, you know, dabbling on it, on the fuels very gently, and so the fuel will be able to absorb it. So again, what will happen, so let's say if we have the same thing where we have the heavy rain, it hits it, a lot of times it will just bounce off the fuel because it's running, it's coming down so hard and so fast that the fuels can't absorb it, and it just runs off. So that's why we get flash floods. So anybody who lives, been in the desert or been in the mountains, and you get these, you know, the downpour, you get this massive amount of water and debris flows and stuff like that, is because the ground can't absorb it. So it's just like water off, it's the old saying, go water off a duck's back. It just pools, it doesn't penetrate, and so it just runs right off. And so it will collect in the creek beds and stuff like that. So been through a few of those kind of floods. So the 1 hour fuel are like flashy fuels, basically are grasses. And these are the fuels that, again, in wildland fire, our light flashy fuels are our most hazardous because they ignite easily and they'll burn real quick. And if you're caught in them, they will kill you. Because the energy, even though it's short duration, it's a lot of energy being released over a short period of time. So if you inhale, that would kill my friend. It was an inhalation of the products of combustion. Superheated gas seared his lungs like that. So again, you got the thermal threat, you got superheated products of combustion, and all these things. That, you know, person tripped, he fell, and then sucked it in. You know, CBA on a wildland fire? No, what they were doing is they were working on trying to protect the structure, and the wind shifted all of a sudden. It came back and they were trying to run for shelter, and he tripped and fell. But the cloud, the superheated cloud of combustion products over hit them, and he, as he fell, you know, he took in a breath and then seared his lungs. So again, there's just a lot of things out there. You got the thermal threat, you got products of combustion, lack of visibility. You could trip and fall and go over an edge or down a canyon or fall off a cliff. I mean, there's just a lot of things to worry about. So our heavy fuels will not respond as quickly to changes. So like, let's say we have a 10-hour fuel or a 100-hour fuel. In order for those fuels to dry out, it would have to be exposed to that for that amount of time to the drier conditions. So let's say if we have a typical 10-hour fuel, which would be like your, you know, heavy brush, you know, the thicker stuff, greater than a quarter of an inch. What will happen with that is that it would need to be, so let's say the fuel moisture is 80% for sake of argument, and then you would need, you have something at like 10% in order to bring that moisture down appreciably, it would have to be exposed to that lower humidity environment for 10 hours to really affect the change of the fuel. Of course, but what would speed it up? Wind. So even with the other fuels that are like 10-hour fuels or 100-hour fuels, if you get a good wind behind it and it's a dry wind, it will dry everything off quickly. So that's why we need to be aware of that. So that's like when we get the dry winds and stuff like that, the fuel moistures can drop so precipitously pretty quickly, even in the thicker fuels. So the four factors of fuel that impact the starting and spread of fire. Fuel types, okay? Is it grass? Is it heavy timber? Is it logging slash? Is it a ground fuel? Is it a surface? Ground fuels is anything below grade. So like, let's say this is the surface. Ground fuels would mean everything below the ground. So like peat bogs, roots, decaying leaves, anything below. Surface fuels are anything that sit on the surface of the ground. It was what those would call that. So let's take a look at the types. Grass found in most areas, predominantly on the south, southwest slope, and the slopes that face the direction of the sun, this is, you're going to see the grasses in that environment. These are light and commonly called one-hour fuels. Shrub, basically brush, could be the small little plants and so forth. Those are a little bit more, like sagebrush, scrub oak, manzanita would be this classification. And a lot of these type of shrub brush type fuels have high oil content. So like manzanita, scotch broom, French broom, all these do, what they do is when the dry season comes, they have an oily texture on their skin and it's designed to keep the moisture from evaporating so it doesn't kill it. So that's why later part of the fire season, the brush has become a very big hazard because of their oil content. They don't have a lot of moisture. They're holding on to your life for what moisture they have. And then all of a sudden you get a good fire burning on it and you get the oils that are in there and the oils start heating up and then they can reach their the oil in the plants can reach flash point or fire point quite readily. Timber and timber litter most dominant in the mountainous areas of the country. So it's like fallen trees, limbs that have snapped off, trees that might have fallen over through natural causes. That would be timber and also heavy timber, big giant trees and in the environment. And then you have logging slash. This is really dangerous because with timber litter and stuff, everything else, you have, you know, the other trees providing shade and keeping it, you know, and also being wind sheltered for the most part. But in logging slash, they've taken all the big stuff and they left the other stuff there and it's dead. And it dries out. And when, you know, it dries out, it's not like the other fuel, the recovery, and it, when it dries out, it is very readily combustible. Let's shut off cell phones. No texting in class, please, because it's distracting. So, regardless of the type of fuel, we have certain properties. So let's talk about these properties that we need to take a look at. Again, we've hit on it earlier, fuel moisture. In the wildland arena, various fuels, depending on the environment, will have either be very dry or it could be very moist. And also too, in the direction, with there's a thing we'll talk about, aspect. And aspect is simply telling you the direction in which that topographical feature faces the sun. So we will give it compass directions just for sake of knowing which way. But so aspect is a direction of that topographical feature to that of the sun. So the south, southwest is going to get sun most of the day, so that's where you're going to have your light, flashy fuels, you know, in that environment. And then the northeast aspect, which is further away from the sun, in the shadow zones of the mountains or the hills, you'll have your heavier fuels. And it'll generally be moist there. And so the fuel moisture is going to be much higher on the northeast aspect or slope than it is going to be on the south-southwest slope, because the southwest slope is getting the sun all the day and that sun is beating on the fuel, and then that fuel starts to heat up, it will start evacuating the moisture from it. Size and shape, okay? It's like anything else. Like we talked about in structural fire environment, right? We have our thin fuels being paper, textiles and so forth. Well, in wildland fuel, leaves and grass are the thin fuels. So if we take a look at the diagram here, we could take a look at the various fuel types. Here's our light fuels. Uniform fuels, meaning that it's a continuity, even though there's different mix of fuel types in here, it's one contiguous piece, meaning that there's no separation between it. Broken fuels, or patchy fuels, you have patches of fuel dispersed throughout. And heavy fuels, here this could be either, this is depicting logging slash. Notice that everything is gone around it, and so all the stuff that's not commercially viable to use is usually left behind. So fuel loading, and this is a concept people get mixed up. Fuel loading, the amount of fuel quantity in a given area. The amount of fuel in an area may not mean the fire will burn with more intensity. It's the quantity of the fuel available for combustion is what concerns us the most. So that fire gets going, how readily is that fuel going to be available for that combustion front? That is what we're really concerned about. And in there's certain parts of Mount Tam, the fuel load per acre is so energy dense, it would be the equivalent of a Hiroshima-sized atomic weapon in energy release. So again, wildland fires have a lot of energy potential to them. Okay, another thing we need to take a look at is how is the fuel arranged? Okay, so remember we talked about the very basic types, but now let's talk about the environment in which the fuels exist. So again, ground fuels are anything below grade. Roots, peat bogs, duff, and so forth. Surface fuels are anything that grow on the surface. And then our aerial fuels are our trees. So if we have a continuity between this smoldering and then this catches on fire, and it catches here, it can climb up, that's called ladder fuel, because it's just like rungs on a ladder. And then the fire can run up to the top, and then get into the crown of the trees. And if there's a wind blowing across those crowns, it's like a freight train. I've seen it. Crown fires are very scary things. So topography. So the weather and all that stuff is pretty much the most unpredictable aspect of trying to chart wildland fire behavior. But topography is one of the few elements, environmental elements, that we can use, and we could chart it with pretty good accuracy, because we know if the slope adjusts varying degrees, we could expect this kind of amount of run on it. If there's a box canyon, if fire gets going in a box canyon, we can expect certain things to happen. So the topographical features make it relatively easy to understand how the fire is going to behave by understanding what those features are. So let's take a look at some of the topographical aspects. All right. So remember we were talking about aspect, right? Aspect is a direction, is the relative orientation of a topographical feature to that of the sun. So if you take a look at this mountain, this could be Mount Tam, this could be Mount St. Helena, this could be Mount Burdell. The southwest exposure is going to usually be very grassy, and then the northeast is going to be your heavy fuels, timber and what have you, over here. So depending on if the fire starts here as opposed to here. But, you know, let's say if we've had a lot of drought in September and October, have been very hot, dry months. And the Oakland Hills fire started in October. The Mount Vision fire started in October. That is a critical time before the substantial first rains hit. It feels going to be at its driest point, even on this side. We live in a Mediterranean environment where, you know, we get all our rain seems to happen between January and March, and then April, May, it starts. Then we can go months and months without rain. Whereas, like in Chicago and stuff like that, places have been, You know, they get rain seem like every few days, even during the summer. And the humidity sucks. I can attest to that. Okay, so slope. Slope is going to have a bearing. So the steeper the slope, that means the fire as it's running up the slope. That convective heating heats the fuel down line, and then that gets heated, and then and it just snowballs. So the steeper the slope, the faster the rate of spread of fire. But that's all you basically need to know. The shape of the country, okay? And it, again, especially people that go into other jurisdictions to fight fire, and you're not familiar with their environmental conditions, is a good way to get yourself killed. So it's really important that when you go into these areas, you know, you usually get fire weather, you're given briefings and so forth. It's really important to take heed to that. Many firefighters have been killed because they have did not listen to that. Storm Mountain in Colorado was a classic example of that. They, instead of fighting fire aggressively and providing for safety first, they decided to fight fire aggressively and not be safe. And when you do that, it usually has fatal consequences to it. So Box Canyon, narrow canyons, and other rugged topographic features will have specific kind of fire behavior situations with them. Box Canyons are one of the worst because the air and the flow, if anybody's either got a fireplace going or know anything about fireplaces or wood-burning stoves, if you get a small fire going in there, you get it to build up a draft, and then once you start going, it takes off. Same thing in a box canyon. These we want to avoid. Because if you're inside this, anywhere inside here, and the fire rips through there, you're gone. I've seen fires rip through box canyons. And so let's say if somebody had a big, thick beard, and you shave your beard off, and no stubble, I've seen it burn right to the ground. I've seen the fire rip through these box canyons, and before you've been there and you've seen it, and you see thick brush, and how can you even get through this? And the fire ripped through there, this hit like it was hit with a flamethrower, burned right to the ground. Narrow canyons, the hazards they present is. And I've seen this, area ignition. White's Hill fire in 1984. We were on a ridge over here. Fire was burning on this side. It was throwing fire brands on this side, and the radiant flux hitting this side. 65 acres, just like that. And it was driving a fire apparatus on the ridge line. Because we were trying to do a firing out operation to go try to see if we could fire back and do it, but the wind shifted, and that area ignition happened, and we're on top of the ridge, and it's just like a vortex like this. It's like being inside a horizontal fire tornado. So we were in there, saw the thing explode, yelled to the guys that were out there, cut the hose. They all jumped in. We started driving. It sucked enough, it dropped the oxygen below 14%. And so internal combustion engines will cease to operate. So we just had to wait for it to, pass. And luckily, it was such a short duration. We just got the paint singed on the side of the engine. But it could have been bad. Malibu fire. We were on one section, and then there was another section, and an engine was coming up the road. The fire fishtailed around that, came up behind him, severely burned a firefighter. So, again, these are very, very unpredictable fire events, and they can do things, so you have to be on top of your game to avoid getting hurt or getting killed. That's just, these things release millions of watts of energy. So wide canyons, depending on their orientation, prevailing wind direction can be altered by the direction of the canyon. So the canyon can alter the prevail because it's being channeled through a physical constriction. Spot fires are not common except when you have high winds in these wide canyons. And then there'll be different firing behaviors depending on if it's on the north or south side of the canyon. On the north side of the facing of the canyon, you're going to have the heavier fuels. On the south side of that canyon, it's going to be the lighter, flashy fuels. So if we take a look at this image here, it's showing a ridge, a spur ridge, meaning they can go, so the fire could burn here and catch this ridge, and it could just send it different directions. Also, this is a bad spot to be in the saddleback. Okay, so it's down here and the fire is burning up in here. You might as well just put a target on your back. And so we try to avoid getting in this environment or on the very top of a ridge line if we can, because the fire will want to eddy over this part. But sometimes you have no choice because you got your fire road and you're doing your defensive thing. And like the situation I was telling you about, the driving along doing a firing out operation, the conditions shifted on a dime. And you know, we were being safe as we could be safe, but things can shift on you and cause severe problems. Saddles are, again, or what we just looked at. You got a ridge, it drops down and then goes up. That's just a big vortex. So the fire is burning, that's going to be the point of least resistance. It's going to want to shoot through that area. Elevation. So what do you think the biggest effective elevation is going to be on a wildland fire? What do you think it's going to be its biggest impact?
The amount of oxygen.
Well, that to a degree, but it's going to be the type of fuels you're going to be dealing with. So as the elevation changes, your fuel types are going to change. So if we take a look at this drawing here, at sea level, you know, you're going to basically have your grasses, and as you go up higher, you start getting into brush, and you go up a little higher, you start getting into what they call the broadleaf or deciduous type forests, maples, laurel bay, oak trees, and you go up even higher between the alpine line and that upper edge of the deciduous forest, you start getting your pine trees. And then above there, you get the little tiny shrubs, little tiny pygmy shrubs and little lichen and stuff, and then you get into the snow line. So the biggest impact of elevation is going to be what type of fuel you'll be dealing with. Barriers. Barriers can be man-made or they can be nature-made. And it could be roads or hand-cut tool lines, you know, tooling through creeks, rock outcroppings, all these things can be used as to your advantage as a wildland firefighter. So knowing what you have and where to put your defensive positions makes all the difference in the world. Again, my experience in wildland firefighting, even though we have the biggest technology and everything else, we used to say the dragon's going to come and kick our ass, and then it's going to decide when to leave. We're not going to have a material impact on when it leaves. Or it's when the weather conditions change, become favorable, then we can, you know, tactically deal with it. But if the weather, you know, you got the Santa Anas and the low humidity and everything else, that fire is going to do what that fire is going to do, and there's not a whole heck of a lot we can do. All we can try and do is get the people out of harm's way, and if the area is tenable for us, to try and protect the communities. But other than that, it's releasing far too much energy to deal with. Cold fronts. And this is how, this was the big culprit that killed my friend in 2003. Passing of a cold front. So what happened, when they were fighting that fire, everything was fine, the winds were offshore, there were the Santa Anas, and then a cold front dropped right down on top of them, the winds switch just like that. Just as fast as I turned my wrist. So the wind direction shifted, now the fire came at them. And I've been in that environment where, you know, you're fighting the fire, you're getting a ring around it, and all of a sudden the winds shift. Well, in our area, this is the most dangerous thing we have to deal with because it throws a lot of unpredictable variables into the wildland fire equation. So, but there are signs we can look for to tell us that something bad is coming our way. So in our area, ahead of an approaching cold front, the winds will start coming out of the south or southwest. Usually tells us that a cold front's coming. Because as that cold front's getting closer, it's squeezing the wind and it's causing the wind to push up that way. Because the colder air is denser than the warmer air. So some of the things we're going to see with the cold front. The associative winds of a typical cold front, southeasterly to southwesterly winds ahead of the cold front, westerly to northwesterly winds behind the cold front. So once the cold front passes, the winds usually come out of the north or northwest, or even directly out of the west, depending on if there's a fog bank driving that cold front. Remember this. This is a possible quiz question. Wind direction is from where the wind is coming from, not blowing to. So when we say an easterly wind, the wind is coming out of the east, blowing to the west. So when we talk about wind direction, it's from where the wind is being generated from, not where it's blowing to. So an easterly wind is telling you the wind's coming from the east and blowing to the west. A westerly wind is coming from the west, blowing to the east. So let's take a look at some of the signs that we could see as a cold front's approaching and hits us. Large clouds of dust can precede the arrival of a cold front. So like open construction yards and stuff like that. You'll see this all of a sudden, just like somebody just hit their hand and dust starts kicking up off the ground. That is telling you that is a good sign of a cold front coming. Winds have a tendency to change from the southeast to the south to the southwest and increase in velocity before the front. So just as a cold front's starting to arrive, the winds become horrific. A line of cumulus clouds can be seen coming from the west or northwest in our area especially. Winds are strongest and erratic and gusty as the front starts to reach you. And I can attest to that. And I was training for, I used to do a lot of time trialing, 40K time trials on road bikes. So I had a special built bike that was basically an airfoil. So I'm going training down this run, riding down this one road. Cold front just all of a sudden dropped down, hit the side of it, threw me over 4 meters to my right. So I'm going this way, the wind hit me and I went flying and I landed and I didn't crash. And I was lucky, but it picked me up and dropped me. And so that was definitely a pucker factor there to deal with. But, and again, the winds will continue to shift as the front passes, generally resulting in strong, gusty, cool winds out of the west or northwest. But it's, as that front comes towards you, that is where the danger is. Because they're gusty, you know, they can be real blustery, then all of a sudden die down and then hit again and die down. So these are all the things we really, really need to be leery of. So let's take a look at the potential dangers. Wind direction is abrupt. Strong southerly winds ahead of the cold front can drive the fire ahead to the north or northeast. And we'll look at the figure in the next page showing you what happens to the wind direction as the front's approaching and as the front passes. So here we have these two, figure two. You can see the wind is coming out of the southwest here, coming out of the south. And you can see that the fire is being driven to the northeast. But now as the front passes, now you can see the fire is being driven down to the southeast. Okay. And again, these are big deals. These are very, very dangerous wildland fire enhancers. Is the coming of a cold front. So the wind shifting to the west or northwest after the front has passed will drive the fire ahead to the southeast or southeast, as we just saw in the previous slide. Rapid drop in relative humidity within 24 hours of a cold front passing. So these cold fronts are usually could be moist, have a lot of moisture in them. But generally what will happen is the cold front passes, then the high pressure systems like to try and reestablish themselves and warm up again to try and bring itself into thermal equilibrium. And so that's why usually after the passing of a cold front, the humidities drop. Phoon winds, these are a dry wind that come down the mountains. And so like during the summer, when the Sierra Nevada or the San Gabriel Mountains or the Southern Sierras get rain, thunderstorms during the day, that usually means that the wind's dropping down the west slope, and it's a very dry wind. So all the moisture is being wrung out of the clouds at the ridges of the mountains. So that's why you'll sometimes that monsoonal moisture you hear about in July sometimes, or the high pressure starts building and starts pushing the air over. Again, it'll suck all the moisture, it'll be sucked out, and then as it drops down, it will be very extremely dry and very warm. Just a point in fact, the Malibu fires in 1995, I had a sling psychrometer, and what a sling psychrometer does, it measures relative humidity. So I went down to the beach, Malibu Beach, by the shoreline, you know, and I was in the sand, and I took this thing and I did 7% humidity. Went up quarter of a mile inland, up on the hills above me, behind the beach, did it again, 3% relative humidity. That means fire happens in those real low humidity environments, the fire is going to burn with extreme ferocity to it. And this fire did do exactly that. And also to think about full moon winds, these wind events last for days. They're not like a typical, well, the wind might be coming out of the east part of the day, and then as that later part of the afternoon comes, then all of a sudden the wind starts coming out of the west. These generally last for days. 40 to 60 mile per hour winds are not uncommon, and it could go as high as 90. I've seen them. These winds snap telephone poles and just take big trees and just snap them right off, or break them, or uproot them. So, and again, they're extremely dry. So let's take a look at the mechanism of how these work. So you have a high pressure system, stable air usually on the other side of the mountain range. And so it starts to spill. So as that pressure starts building and gains elevation, it exceeds the physical height of the mountain range. And then all of a sudden it spills over. And so when it spills over, the moist air, you'll start getting a lot of thunderstorms and activity up on the mountains. Like Tahoe and stuff like that will get a lot of that. And then all of a sudden this air is dry. So as air falls down and pushes, it compresses, becomes very warm, and it's very dry. And this is what fuels these fires. And these wind events, again, a phone wind is a wind event that lasts for days, not hours. So it will have plenty of time to dry out the fuels. If they're not already bone dry, they'll be more bone dry. So let's talk about the types based on region. So a Chinook wind found in the eastern slopes of the Rocky Mountains, Santa Ana or Southern California, mono or north wind is what our version is in Northern and Central California, and east wind in Western Washington and Oregon. valley winds. Okay, valley winds, these are a local phenomenon. And what they are is during the day, as the topography starts to heat, what happens to air? It's going to rise. So if we take a look here, and these are valley winds during the day. They're upslope, and at night, you can see as the air cools, it's going to flow and go downslope. And usually, up valley winds are usually 10 to 15 miles per hour, and the down valley winds usually 5 to 10. And so these are very small microclimate driven winds, and they can play a factor. They can sneak and bite you if you're not aware of them. So are there any questions on anything we've talked about tonight about wildland fire behavior? Anything at all? I know some people in here have a little bit of wildland experience behind them, and there's some people that don't have any whatsoever. Believe me, I've been there where I didn't know diddly squat about it, and I'm still learning. You know, even though the years and years of fighting these things and studying these things, I'm always learning something new with them. The way I look at all fires, even though they have basic mechanisms, each one's like a fingerprint. They're very individual because they could be small little micro things, micro environment or fuel shifting and so forth and so on, that make the fires individuals just as much as we're individuals. So we don't want to assume, because this fire is burning in this grass and the wind is coming here, it's going to do this, this, and this. You always want to be aware of what other extenuating circumstances, what other factors are there that we're not paying attention to. That is where people get hurt and get killed. So that's why we want to be very, very careful in this environment. Again, I can't stress enough how deadly these events are. And just being lackadaisical about it is a recipe for disaster. All right, so I haven't done roll yet. So you want to take a 10-minute break, and then go over the oral. We got to put the oral groups together. We need to get that up and running. It will probably be an early night tonight, because I know the other days have been taking you right like up to 10. And like I said, if we get stuff done that we need to get done, I have no problem letting people out a little earlier. So what we'll do now is we'll go ahead and form our oral groups.